Tonight's episode of Colors of the Dark is brought to you by Immortal Pleasures. Immortal Pleasures is a seductive dark fantasy novel from V. Castro, author of The Haunting of Alejandra. Hundreds of years ago, she was known as La Malinche, a Nahu woman who translated for the conquistador Cortez. Her name has gone down in infamy, but no one ever found out what happened to her. In the ashes of the empire, she was reborn as Mali Nali, an immortal Aztec vampire who roams the modern world in search of vengeance and love. Now she's on the most perilous adventure of all, a journey into her own desires. Immortal Pleasures by V. Castro is available wherever books are sold.
This week's episode is brought to you by Utopia, presenting the film Omen, the acclaimed feature debut from artist-turned-director Balogi, winner of the prestigious Cannes Film Festival New Voice Prize. Ostracized by his family but forced to return home to fulfill a marriage ritual, Kofi is confronted by the complexities of culture and destiny when his unwanted return is met with controversy and accusations of dark magic. As his story becomes intertwined with other outsiders accused of sorcery and witchcraft, Omen becomes a deeply profound exploration of life, death, and rebirth in the phantasmagoria of Africa. IndieWire calls Omen intoxicating, a visually striking, deeply compassionate, and memorable debut. Now playing in select theaters, get tickets at www.omen.film.
And welcome to Colors of the Dark. I'm your co-host, Rebecca McKendry, and with me is Elric Kane. How you doing? It's like summer again here.
It's hot, but guess what today is? The day this episode is landing. That's what's important.
5 days till your birth, 3 days till your birthday, and 1 day since Ernie's birthday.
On my birthday. This episode is airing on my birthday.
On your birthday. Oh, I just see what you did
there.
So
technically,
it's airing Friday.
Yeah, we're recording this now, but really we should just be celebrating now because we'll never get to celebrate on the birthday, see?
Well, a happiest of birthday to you, Kane.
Oh, it just feels weird doing that. Let's wait till my birthday.
Oh, really? Oh, now I can't. You just went to all that great.
I was excited and then I realized I don't want to. I need to be on an adventure to feel like I'm having a birthday.
That's it? You can't have a birthday at home?
No, I can't. But also, yes, happy birthday to Ernie behind the scenes. Recording this audio right now.
Yes, Ernie has been listening to us for a very long time. And so, yeah, we love Ernie. Happy birthday. So, Kane, what is the cake or pie of choice? I remember that you usually go more pie than cake. But, like, if it's your birthday, what is, like, the one thing that you ask for? Or is it, like, the chocolate with the shaved stuff on top that your mom used to make?
So, my mom makes a chocolate roll cake that she kind of invented it. And I have since learned the recipe. I can, like, follow her video. I've got a video of it, so it's, I can follow along. It's pretty complex. It takes a long time. I would love to have that once a year. That's, like, my dream. But I am a pie over... Not on my birthday, but in general, yes, I'm a cherry pie over cake guy. I'm a Twin Peaks guy.
I remember that.
At my core, so...
I always ask for carrot cake because that's not something every time you go to buy carrot cake in stores, it's going to have walnuts in it. Like that's just common in carrot cake. And so I always want someone to make me carrot cake without the walnuts. Mm. And that's like my birthday present is like my nut-free carrot cake with way too much cream cheese frosting.
Well, it ain't your birthday. You're going to have to wait.
I know it isn't. I got to wait like 6 more months.
You're a October horror birthday gal.
I am. So, but we saw a lot together this past couple of weeks. So let's start with the first Omen.
Wait, did we see many things together? I'm trying to think if I saw anything else with
you. Not together, together, but we have several of the same.
Yes.
Things,
yeah. I think we have a couple, but we have a big one. Yeah. That obviously came out. We saw it kind of on opening night.
We saw this. Yeah, this is why I was confused. I feel like we saw this 3 weeks ago, which I think we did. But that said, we saw First Omen, which we were fresh from Immaculate. And so I think we were kind of walking in, expect it to be like an apocalypse versus like what was the two asteroid movies
Deep
that
Rising,
came out back to back?
Deep Rising and
Deep
Armageddon.
Deep Impact. Deep Rising is like my favorite movie.
Deep
Impact versus what was the other one?
Armageddon.
Like where, you know, they're so kind of similar in pacing that like it's difficult to remember the beats of one versus the other. And this was not the case.
Well, let me read to you the Immaculate description for Immaculate, okay?
Is this your description?
No, from IMDb.
Like IMDb
from Immaculate. A young American woman is sent to Rome to begin a life of service to the church, but encounters a darkness that causes her to question her faith and uncovers a terrifying conspiracy that hopes to bring about the birth of evil incarnate.
Okay, that's immaculate. Now read me First Omen.
Actually, no. I just tricked you. That's First Omen. But it just goes to show that they have the exact same storyline.
It is.
I literally have been thinking about it nonstop, how funny it is, but how they're also both bangers, and they're both two of the better horror films this year, which is pretty funny. It's pretty weird.
That's the weirdest thing. Yeah. And they both, it's the exact same story, I have to say, with minor differences, and this isn't a spoiler because you know it's coming, about how the Antichrist is being born into the world.
Yeah.
That's kind of where the only prominent plot differences occur.
But down to the failed backstory, like if you don't want to know anything about this, either of these movies you might want to skip, but like even down to like how the pregnancies operated and failed, it's like crazy. Yeah.
Down to the backstory of the girls who are nuns to be, who are being brought to Rome,
yeah,
and why they have been selected to this, down like it is literally like almost creepy the way that this happens,
because
they are so just meticulously similar, but somehow both highly fucking watchable. And both good. Like, that was the thing. I found myself cheering and happy about both of them to the point where, whereas I walked out of Armageddon and Deep Impact and immediately was like, let's compare and contrast them. I don't want to do that with these because they're both so good.
Yeah. I think there's interesting comparisons. It's like, I think when I first walked out of First Omen, I was like, oh no, Immaculate's the better movie slightly in terms of the, because I think the thing that Immaculate did so well was told a very, very simple story, and they told it very well and with a bit of sense of humor about itself. I don't remember the visuals particularly of that film, except for maybe the last sequence. That's not what lingered. Whereas First Omen is one
First
of the best,
Omen
yeah.
is shot beautifully.
Yeah, Arkasha Stevenson, who's somebody we, you know, was on our mental radar because of her being picked up by Nick and Costa and Tosca for the series Channel Zero back in the day, kind of having only done her short. And you see it pay off here because you see her sense of visual designs. Like, it's one of the best, I'd say, visual horror films the last few years in terms of just how they're building. I think one of the things that hinders it slightly is that it's kind of overly complex because of the Omen backstories. And it forces into it.
They're really kind of, and I didn't mind it, mm-hmm. but that's the thing, is they are very much trying to figure out how do we get back to where that one began. And they're kind of weaving it through the whole thing. And they did so cleverly. I got to say, I appreciated the First Omen a lot because it took harder swings with horror. And I mean, Immaculate went balls to the wall as well, but it did so in kind of a more like exploitation, like jaw drop way. First Omen was really pushing like how much vag we saw throughout the whole thing.
Well, I thought you would never, like, it kept hinting, like, and if, you know, again, if you haven't seen it yet, it has these shots.
I don't think that it has vag in it is going to like, no. Oh God, now I know the movie.
Well, it's not that it has vag, it has what's inside that. But yes, it has these shots that are hinting.
And now you've made everybody go see it.
Well, good,
so.
Good. But it has these shots that are hinting at it, and you get, they look like they're shot in a way that
he's saying hinting at vagina.
It's a childbirth.
You've got a
woman's legs.
Oh, and childbirth. Yeah.
Woman's legs apart. But the way it's shot is like, oh, like the classic way you would basically shoot it when you weren't going to be allowed to show the thing you're trying to show. So instead of you saw a little bit more than you would. And then suddenly it goes full tilt. And it's one of the most, also because of what's happening, I won't spoil that part. The horror of the scene is also what, it's got to be one of the most edgy images of the last like 20 years put in a movie. But it's unreal. I heard an interview with her on The Big Picture, and it was so funny. Okay, that's the image that everyone who watches this movie would be like, how did she get that image into this movie? Like, how did she pull this off? In her pitch to Disney, she started with that image, and it is why the film got greenlit. That image is that was her wild swing. She went into Disney. She pitched this idea that you would see the what you see. I don't want to ruin it for everyone. And that was the thing that
you would see what came
out.
The
room went quiet. I think it was somebody like, it was not David Ayer, but it was somebody who produced the movie who makes good horror. So it makes sense. But the person in the room was like, oh yeah, that's the pitch. And so probably if she hadn't pitched that, she wouldn't have gotten this gig. So it's so cool that the thing that is least like it'd be like, you know, pitching Possession and going like he did, which is actually how Zulawski pitched. He said a woman fucks an octopus monster. And it was like, so the idea that this thing is the thing you would shy away for or try to sneak into your movie as the thing she got greenlit is so cool. It was a really
That
interesting interview.
is.
It's pretty inspiring to see her pull off a movie like this on a studio. It's a shame this one didn't do as well financially as Immaculate. I think obviously timing can't be great.
I think that it was very much like a strategic thing on Immaculate's part to wait until Omen locked their weekend and then say, we're going to go a weekend before. Because, and this is definitely where like my expertise lies. If we look back to 1989, the year of Aquatic Horror, everybody had Leviathan, Deep Star Rising, like or Deep Steep Star Six.
Right.
They were all coming out like within that same year. They waited for Abyss to lock their slot, and then everybody preceded it. So it feels like we still had these Year of Aquatic Horror, but they were all kind of riding Abyss's wake, but did so before it locked its slot. So
Interesting.
yeah, it was very I think that's done
I
intentionally.
think the lead in
But
this is sensational. Nell Tiger, free from the Servant TV show. She is definitely doing in a Johnny-like thing. There's all these Possession references and all the
Oh, it's so
so
many
many.
Suspiria references. I can't even call it like it's not winking at Possession. It's like making out with it.
Yeah,
Like it's
fully.
a blatant scene. We actually met a listener in the lobby, and that was like one of the first things that he said to us was like, "Do y'all catch the Possession scene?" We were like, "Oh yeah,
But
like
it was in a way
that
that
was
wasn't
blatant."
grown for me. Like it was maybe a little too many by the end for me, just a couple, but in general, that feeling of making it your own and her visual language. The thing I'd love to see, again, I don't know how exactly this did financially, but I would love to see her just continue this. I know they show a photo of the original Omen at the end, which to me was probably a mistake, like probably clever, but I think by doing that now you can't necessarily make the next one, but I would like to see them make this storyline with if she was coming back to it. It would be cool to see them do a redux of the original Omen, maybe change shit up, like mess around with it a little bit, you know?
Oh my God, the number of people that I saw online going, Damien has to be born of a
I saw
jackal.
that,
His mom's the jackal. And I mean, there was at least like six on my own Facebook page. And I was just like, seriously, y'all, seriously, this is the soapbox we're all going to die on here is that somewhere in the original mythos, it says his mom's the jackal. And it explains it. It explains, like, okay, here's how the jackal comes in. And it gets way fucked up with the jackal. Let me just say that. Like, that is some fucked up exploitive stuff that we're finding out with the jackal, like cringy shit.
Oh, the mother.
But
You're saying
that
the mother, yeah,
said,
not the father. Because the father we do see at one point, and he does look like
And
creature-ish.
it's totally
Yeah,
a
it's a creature
jackal.
thing,
Like
yeah.
you think like, okay, well, that's some type of weird demon dog. Okay, jackal. But that is what I saw, this like fervor of like people online pushing their glasses up the brim of their nose saying, well, actually, Damien's mother has to be the jackal. And it
Interesting,
was,
yeah. No, I will say this might be the
oh.
first thing I've seen this year where I already want to go back and rewatch it almost just because, like, the first time you're watching it, you have all these expectations. It's the only one where the images have made me go, oh, yeah, I kind of want to see that one more time while it's still in theaters, you know?
It was just some really cool
Yeah,
imagery. So,
it's a good movie.
okay. So the next thing that I think, was that the
No,
only
we
thing
both saw Imaginary,
we both watched
which we're
Imaginary.
a little
Okay.
late on that one, but we caught up.
Yeah. We decided since we were having Jeff Wadlow on the show a couple of weeks ago that we weren't going to watch it that week, because we hadn't been able to get to the theaters yet. So now like a month and a half later, we're catching back up with it. Obviously, and I don't think this is a surprise to anybody, it did not do very well. Definitely got some negative reviews in there, and I completely understand them, but I gotta say, I liked the first half. Like, I was watching it, and at least like the first 30 to 40 minutes, I was going, I don't know why this got such bad reviews. I'm really enjoying it. And then it like did something crazy in the latter half, and that's when it lost
It's
me.
kind of
So,
structurally reminded me a lot of another Blumhouse film from a couple months ago, Night Swim, because Night Swim
nice
had a really
one.
good
Same.
setup as well, and then just
Same
kind
great
of
setup.
goes off and doesn't work. Yeah, I was surprised. I was sitting there really expecting not to like it, not because of Jeff, obviously. I was excited when it, but seeing the initial reviews, I was like, oh, I'm gonna hate this kind of thing. And I actually found it quite captivating at the start and quite creative in some of its, you know, storytelling choices. And there's a giant bear thing that's quite savage and quite frightening in the right light. I was actually pretty impressed with some of those practical moments. But yeah, it just maybe runs out of steam a little bit, and some of the character dynamics become a little less believable by the end. But not bad. Like, I didn't dislike it, and I was like, oh, okay,
It
this is
wasn't as
interesting.
bad as I was expecting it to be, I gotta say. But what I felt like could have been a different way to approach it. The movie, it starts out very small and quaint, where it's like two people in a house and a stuffed bear. And hey, the bear seems to be doing weird stuff. Like it starts out really contained and quaint. By the end, it has blown up a bajillion times over. You are in this massive concept. It's high production, high concept, and it has like four different endings, and it misses every single one of those endings and just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger every single time. Like that ending scene alone had to cost several million dollars. And I just kept thinking, looking back at something like an Insidious, what is the version of this that stays in the house and stays self-contained? Like that is, I feel like I just don't know if it needed to blow up as big as it
Yeah,
did at
like
the end. So
limitations might have actually benefited at
sometimes
something.
make it,
Yeah,
yeah,
fine.
like
Insidious,
I
it
look at
certainly
like,
did. Yeah, you're right.
yeah, like there small like movies like The Pact or something like that, where the ending is forced to be or even like The Conjuring. I look at it as an example because you think like The Conjuring, it feels like it goes big at the end, but it's still just a crazy woman in her
Oh, no,
basement.
I mean,
Like
you
it never
look.
really.
Compare it to Conjuring 2, and you see that huge difference. Like, Conjuring 2 just makes us such a bigger canvas, and it just starts to lose some of the threads as it goes. And no, I totally agree. I think the
Conjuring
same here.
one, still just crazy woman tied to a chair in her basement, threatening people until she's not crazy anymore. Like I keep thinking that, like, you know, what is the horror that does not explode at the end? And is there something that is equally smart inside
Well,
of
and
that?
yet
So,
one of the problems, I think, and I can only imagine, but you can imagine the pitch of an imaginary is probably the ending kind of puzzle box, big scale is probably what's getting somebody excited about it. But as a viewer, I agree with you completely. Like, you want to go the other way. So, yeah, that's some daylight between audience and studios, perhaps.
I gave you homework this week, but you didn't do what I gave you 2 weeks ago. Two weeks ago, all I said is, would you please just watch the trailer for Hazbin Hotel? Not even the first fucking episode, just the trailer. And you never did. And that's your loss because it's fucking brilliant. But now I told you just to watch the cold open for Parasite the Grey. I know you're not going to watch the first episode. Did you watch, I mean, the first 4 minutes?
4 minutes. How am I gonna get 4 minutes into my busy schedule, Becca?
Oh
I
my
you sent
God.
it late last night, so I actually haven't. But
I
that's all.
didn't send it. It was 2 nights ago because I've made it through four
It was
episodes.
late last night, and you watched 4 episodes. I'm
No,
telling
it
you.
wasn't. It was
All right,
Sunday. It was Sunday.
sell me and the
Okay,
world,
fine.
because none of us have heard of this.
Well, I'll just describe the cold open
Okay.
poorly since you couldn't sacrifice 4 minutes of your ever busy
I just
time.
forgot.
Okay, so it opens and we are at an EDM concert, like for us old fogies, kind of like, you know, it's electronic dance. It feels kind of like a rave. And there's a DJ and everybody's going crazy. And all of a sudden, it starts raining these little globules of goo from the sky. And they hit the ground and they immediately start moving. And then within seconds, these worm-like things burst out of each one of these little balls of goo, climb up people's legs, and go in through their ears or mouths. And then immediately, their heads burst open in a sea of tentacles, which they then start killing other people at the concert
I'll
with.
watch the first 10 minutes then.
It's amazing. It
That
is
sounds cool, yeah.
amazing. So talking Parasite the Grey. I'm very familiar with the Parasite. It's based on a manga series, and there were Parasite movies that I actually really enjoyed back in 2014. They did the first one, 2015 was the second. I had actually first become acquainted with this franchise through the 2014 movie, which I saw at AFM 1 year, and which is American Film Market. It's like this little industry festival that we have in Santa Monica every year right after Halloween. So I
I
had
think it just
seen.
moved to Vegas from now on. I just saw
Oh,
it. I
did
saw a
it?
press release about it. A big deal, because Santa Monica was losing it.
Yeah, that is a big deal. Oh my gosh. Okay. Well, now it gives me a reason to go to
Yeah,
Vegas. So
Vegas.
cool. So yeah, Parasite, the 2014 one is what I was describing. It's a self-contained story about a kid. He's like 15 who becomes infected with this alien parasite, but he is able to control it to a degree. It takes over one of his arms and he can basically turn his hand into anything, which is really cool. So it's the same basic principle in this. It's still kind of playing in that larger franchise of these parasites rain down from the sky. They take over human bodies, and then after they do that kind of crazy head transformation thing at the concert, all of the other people across the globe who become infected with these, the parasite's main goal is to kind of keep a low profile, to not make their heads explode, because they're trying to collect their numbers so then they can take over the world. But what we quickly discover happens if somebody is injured or gravely sick. When the parasite enters their body, the parasite has to focus all of its power and energy on healing the body first. And so a lot of times it can't fully take over the person's brain. And that's what happened. It's actually this really cool scene where this girl is running from a slasher and she ends up getting stabbed multiple times right as the parasite enters her body. When she wakes up, the cops are like, "Well, at least he didn't get you." And she's like, "No, what the fuck? I got stabbed like three times." And she looks and she just has marks on her belly, but the parasite has healed her. But then she quickly realizes that there is something that's kind of sharing her brain. And so not everyone is completely gone. Some people kind of like share the consciousness with this alien parasite now. This is really fun, goes super hard. It's really big, giant CG monsters. Don't expect them to look practical. They're definitely not, but I thought they were still very fun looking. It's getting really high reviews. I watched the first two on Sunday night and then two more episodes last night, and it's been a
Right, and this
blast.
is a
So I really want to
series that
keep
is
going.
part two of a movie or part two of a series.
No,
The first one
this
was a series.
is it's unconnected to the movies or anything
Oh.
like that. It's just the same
Okay.
world. It's like if you took Bird Box and picked it up and plopped it in
Which they
Barcelona or
did, right?
plopped it
Yeah.
wherever. Yeah, it's like so this global phenomenon happened. And then from that, that was originally a manga comic book series. They had two movies. There may have even been some other media. And then now this concert and or sorry, this particular series. So this series, it's still just kind of based on the same global phenomena.
Cool.
Yeah, this is fun. It's a lot of fun. Big giant tentacle monsters.
It sounds like your jam.
You
Complete.
know it.
Big one that isn't really horror, but I'll give it a quick mention that a lot of people are in the discourse over is Civil War, directed by Alex Garland.
I'm seeing it on Friday. I'm tempted to put my fingers into my ears
Maybe I
and
shouldn't.
hum.
Maybe I shouldn't bring it up then. It's a big dystopia film. I'm a big Alex Garland fan, and I did not like it. And so,
It's got like a 3.9 on
yeah,
Letterboxd right now, dude.
a
Oh my
lot of people
gosh.
love it, and I don't begrudge that. It's actually one of those kinds of movies, one of the few kinds of movies where I don't think that's like wrong. Like somebody walks out loving it, somebody doesn't like it. Some people don't like it because it's not, maybe firmly making a political stance. It's kind of making it somewhat even, which will surprise a lot of people, kind of to an extent. There's some things that are being said, but that wasn't anything to do with it for me. I think one of the problems is I think it will really work for people who aren't horror people because it's really intense and it has this like war ravaged post-apocalypse landscape. And it's like for somebody who's gone through all the Romero films and like, and not that this is a zombie film, I didn't see images that were new to me, and there was something about that that was a bit of a bummer. It has a real intensity. It has a lot to say, especially about photojournalism, and which is really interesting. And I really like the performance by Kirsten Dunst. There's a lot of things to like. It's a very well-made movie. It's his biggest by far. I just think that this was one of the first films I've seen in a while where I was like, man, I wish he had given this script to Danny Boyle, his longtime kind of early part collaborator, because I think Danny Boyle's just so much better with human stuff and emotions. And my thing was, I didn't care and I'm about anyone and I didn't care about anything. And I was watching it going, oh man, I really wanted to care. But I went with my friend Star and I was just like, man, I didn't ever feel inside that movie, like not even for a scene really, even though I was watching it going, wow, that's really well made. And so again, maybe it'll be a movie 10 years from now, I watch it again and feel totally different. It has that potential because it's definitely not a bad movie. Very well made and put together. But yeah, I just was outside of it. But it does have quite a lot to say about what could happen in a type of America. And maybe it's also the timing is tough because of where we really are. But interesting movie. He said he probably won't direct for a little while. You know, he's going to go back to doing some screenwriting because this was such a big movie, probably for him. And he really does say he's a writer. Like, that's what he is at his core. He's directed because he had to get these movies done the way he wanted. But mm-hmm. I think deep down, he's kind of like, oh man, that was exhausting from the interviews I've been listening to. But you could really love this. Like, I'm not trying to put you off it, really. It's that kind of movie.
So this is how long it takes to make like big movies like this. That was shooting in Jackson, Mississippi, the same time we were shooting Glorious.
Gee.
And because they got shut down for COVID possibly twice. And we picked up some of their crew during those interims. And our production designer was working on both productions. He was running back and forth because he kept coming back and saying, I don't know, A24 is shooting some Civil War film, like two sound stages down. And I kept wanting to go down and say hi, but they also kept getting shut down for COVID. But yeah, and as soon as he said A24 Civil War film, I'm picturing like a historical Civil War film. Yeah. And that's what I thought he had meant. And I kept thinking, when is that like historical, like North versus South Civil War film coming out from A24? Until I finally saw the trailer for this and I was like, oh, it's like dystopian Civil War. I get it now.
But not so far. Like, it's not set in the future, if you know what I mean. It's set right now, but a slightly different version of America right now. So, it's got a couple sequences that have stuck with me afterwards, like just a couple sequences that are particularly kind of harrowing. The cool thing is people are talking about it and they're really discussing its merits and that's rare these days, I feel like, when people are like really picking apart at a movie. So, and it's a big costly. I think it's A24's most expensive movie and it seemed to do very well on opening weekend. So, you know, it could work out for them. So, we shall see.
Well, I'm supposed to go Friday night. So yeah, we'll see. Okay. So also coming out, I believe it's this weekend. It might be the following, but this is Infested, which is coming from France. Director is Sebastian Vanacek. I said that right. And he, as I was looking up today to see what Sebastian Vanacek has done, he'd only done a series of short films. He'd done like four or five short films before Infested. But now if you go on his IMDb, it says he is writing and directing an untitled Evil Dead spinoff.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, that's definitely a big swing off this. But you watch Infested and you get why he would get that so quickly and why that is the next thing. So Infested, I'd been hearing about this one and heard how amazing it was. So I knew I was going to love this at Giant Spiders.
I think it won Fantastic Fest last year. And that's where the word started coming out. Like, it was.
Yep.
I'm so
that doesn't surprise me. It is set in a very, we'll call it apartment slums in France. And so it's very much like a rundown kind of feels, you know, they're wonderful people. All the neighbors know each other, that they go, they really want to show that everybody in the building knows each other. They all love each other. They all support each other. They all take care of each other. When somebody is sick, the other neighbors bring stuff, but that it is a very impoverished, rundown building. And this brother and sister have inherited an apartment there from their mother, who has recently died. The brother is in his 30s and the sister's a little older than him. And they are living there. She is kind of disgusted by the whole building. She's like, ugh, we deserve better than this. And she's trying to renovate the apartment and make it really fancy. He loved growing up there. All of his friends live in the building that he grew up with. He grew up with all of these neighbors around him. So he is very much sees this as a community that he wants to support. His obsession is bugs and reptiles. And so his room is filled to the, he reminds me of my son. His room is filled to the brim with bugs and spiders and different types of reptiles in cages. And his main focus is taking really good care of them. He talks to them. He focuses on how much to feed them and things like that. He's getting, he goes to visit this black market bug dealer, which is a thing, I have to say. Having spiders now, it's a thing that you can like get bugs on the internet and from weirdo places. But he gets this spider that the guy doesn't really know much about, but he's like, I don't know, pay me like $80. You can have this weirdo spider. And you see where the spider comes from at the beginning. It's a really cool scene. I won't spoil that. But he acquires this weirdo spider. And he takes it home and he puts it into a Nike shoebox. You also get he's been selling like high-end sneakers out of the basement. And there's questions about whether he legally has them or not. But yeah, he puts the spider into a Nike shoebox. He goes off, does some stuff, come back home. And the spider has chewed a hole through the bottom of the shoebox. And then we quickly realize that this spider was pregnant and it starts just, you know, one spider becomes 10 and it's replicating at a record pace. And with each replication, they get bigger and bigger and bigger. Whereas most killer spider movies, and I'm looking at you, Arachnophobia, Eight-Legged Freaks, even Stung or Sting, which we just watched last show, definitely fall into kind of the horror comedy vein where they understand kind of the humor, the tongue-in-cheekness of fighting a giant spider. This takes it so dead fucking serious. They may as well have been fighting zombies or slashers. It is taken. And I think that that's what makes it so good is it feels so different. I went into this expecting it to be, considering the setting, kind of in the slum setting, I was expecting it to be Attack the Block with spiders instead of giant fuzzy aliens is honestly how I was thinking that the movie would play out. It did not. It is the Attack the Block setting, but it is taken so deadly seriously of kind of bringing the building together against these spiders. And yeah, this was fantastic. There's a lot of light and dark play because they realize, as most spiders do, they're nocturnal. So if you flip the lights on, most spiders will stop moving, which is why when you see a spider on your ceiling, it's not moving, but as soon as the lights go off, it's like crawling towards your face. So they use that a lot, that like, that's their kind of, their combativeness is like the lights. And so it's just, it's filmed beautifully. There's a lot of really clever stuff in it. I can't say enough good things about this movie. I loved it. This is Infested.
Thanks for the screener people in screener land. Wherever they exist.
They send it. So sometimes when we get screeners, it's like, here's a screener for both of you. And then other times they'll send it to one of us and it's a single link and we can't share.
That one I really am excited to see. But then maybe it'd be fun in a theater. Like that could be.
This would be.
Yeah, so maybe
this would be a really. I will say watching it on my computer screen, because so much of it is like the darkness of the building, because it is a really, really drab rundown building versus the light. Like some of the scenes were super dark on my computer to the point where I couldn't see what was going on. And I kept thinking this would look so much different if it was in a theater than on my like shitty 10-year-old Mac. So yeah, I would recommend theatrical for this one.
No, I'm excited for that one. And I have an exciting one too. I think you got this one, but you might not have watched it yet. Arcadian.
I haven't. Okay. I just got it 2 days ago. Mark Ward highly recommended this.
This got big, nice buzz out of South by Southwest. It was, and most people just saw a still of Nicolas Cage with two teenage boys in kind of a little driving vehicle. And, you know, I'm in the bag already.
A little driving vehicle?
It's, in other words, not a car, but something like that. Hybrid goal.
I thought you were trying to describe a car, and I was like, little driving vehicles. We call them cars now, Kane.
I was bit by a mass of spiders. So I would have gone just for the Nick Cage of it. But here's the exciting thing for me. The director of this, Benjamin Brewer, who I knew nothing about till recently, directed a movie that a friend of mine watched, friend of ours, Dick, watched on Tubi last year. And he was like, oh my God, this is like the best Nick Cage movie that no one watches because it's on Tubi. I went to it. This is called The Trust with him and Elijah Wood. And it is fucking awesome. It's like one of the best, like when you just end up on Tubi, it's like one of the best last Cage movies in the last decade. It is so fun and goofy.
It's called The Trust.
Yeah, it's basically him as a... what is even their job? They are in the place where you store evidence for the cops, and they are related to like the evidence locker kind of thing. And
I was going to say, we call those evidence rooms.
Yeah, evidence rooms. They have something to do
like,
with
it. We call them driving vehicles.
They start to notice a pattern of something, and they basically clue in that somebody is doing something shady in Vegas. And Nick Elijah Wood's really funny, actually. He's like the assistant to him who's like getting high all the time. And Cage kind of keys in like, maybe there's a big score we could make if we rip off this this motel where we think all the stuff's being stashed. And it goes in directions you wouldn't expect. It's a great Cage role. It's just a terrific movie that I, when I see the poster for it, I would never watch this unless somebody told me to. And that's why I didn't for so long. Watched on Tubi a few months ago and loved it. Well, this is his follow-up. So, and it's been a few years. And he also wrote that movie Reptile last year that was really cool on Netflix, that crime thriller one. And he's the visual effects artist on things like Everywhere, Everyone, All, Everyone, Everywhere, All at Once. He does like visual effects for those guys. So he's like, anyway, I don't know much about him personally, but I got really excited after watching The Trust. So I had, that made me a bit more excited about this. It opens post-apocalyptic, no explanation. You're just Nicolas Cage trying to survive an apocalypse. You don't know what's going on in the first couple of minutes with two babies. And then it goes dark. Then it's like 17 years later or whatever. And he on a farm, rural farm, he has been teaching the survival instincts to these two boys. And it's really, at first, it's kind of slow for a while. And you're like, oh, okay, it's going to be this kind of sci-fi movie where something comes at night that they have to hide from. You have to be in lockdown by the time darkness comes. That's the rules. There's some farms left in this world, but probably cities are decimated. They don't ever talk about what it is in the first like 20, 30 minutes. So at first you would think this is not going to be a Becca movie, I would say. Like as you're watching, you'd be like, oh, this is fine. But I was enjoying it. I like this kind of a vibe. And then when it, and it's about their, you know, the two brothers are very different. One is kind of like designing things and likes to like build things like this little car thing that I was telling you about. And Nick Cage, this is not what I would call a great Nicolas Cage movie. This is a pretty great movie. It's a smaller Cage role, but it's cool because it's like he's using his name for it. It works because the father plays a key role for these sons and it's kind of a coming of age story. So it needs him to take a back seat for some of this movie for that, for it to work. So I think it shows some growth on his part that he's willing to even do that for a smaller movie. When the creatures hit, so you have one of the brothers is struggling to get home at night one day and falls in a cave, forcing Nick Cage to kind of venture out with, you know, some fire and, you know, weapons and stuff because we don't know what's coming. And then you start to see, and I'm not going to ruin, because I didn't watch the trailer, so it might be in the trailer. So people might have already had this ruined for them. But there is a very slow build of the first creature, like the main creature reveal, which is one of the best moments of the year. It is so clever and funny and weird. And the creature just increasingly gets wilder and does more and more wild things. And you will love it. From the moment the creature feature starts, you are going to love this movie. And it's really, and it just moves like a crazy bat of hell pace for the whole second half of this movie. And it's a pure creature feature. So it's like a coming of age creature feature. Can't stand up. It's honestly one of the most fun things I've seen this year. And just a nice surprise, because even in the first 20 minutes, you wouldn't think that's where this is headed, the way it's kind of designed. So, yeah, I wouldn't. I'd like to talk to this guy. I'd be very curious to hear more about his background and stuff. But, yeah, high recommend this one coming out. Well, it's in some theaters already. So it's in one theater in L.A. right now, which means if RLJ, it's probably, I don't know if it's headed to Shudder, but it means it's probably,
I would assume it's heading there eventually.
I think you're gonna really dig this. I was thinking from the still, I was thinking it was gonna be like that movie Love and Monsters in kind of a fictional world.
That's what I had gathered because I saw a couple pictures from it and I was like, oh, it's Love and Monsters with Nick
which
Cage.
I really like that movie, but the tone is, you know, cutesy and kind of teeny. In that sense, in a good way, this is a straight, like once it starts going, this is a straight horror film. And that's what's really cool about it. It's nothing cutesy about it. And the creatures are just really original. They just do a number of things where I was like, whoa, like really fun, a fun movie. So can't say enough good things. Arcadian, put it on your list.
Okay. I am hoping to catch up with that one next week. Okay. You know what? I am going, before I head to my books, how many more films do you have left?
I have one more on here.
Okay. I have a YouTube channel I just wanted to plug, and it's been around for a really long time, but I'm late to the fucking party, y'all, on this one. And then I'll dig into some graphic novels I've been reading. So Life of Luxury. Now, this thing has 8 million subscribers. It's been around since 2019. So obviously, I'm just going to assume that like a chunk of our audience has already been watching this. But I sat down last Sunday, very rainy Sunday, with my kids because they were like, hey, mom, do you want to watch some horror stuff? And I was like, do go on. And they were like, let's watch Life of Luxury. And it's a YouTube channel. And so it's two guys, Chester and Tommy. And they, the first couple of videos that they showed me were Chester and Tommy doing like supernatural investigator stuff. Like this girl says she's being woken up by an entity every night. Let's see if we can record it. It's shot really low res, super grainy, black and white, almost night cam. So they can do some really cool stuff with monsters and it actually looks legit. Now, where I got really interested Is and they have, like I said, 8 million subscribers. So I'm assuming that most of our listeners have encountered this in some capacity, and I'm just late to the party. But they have a separate kind of spin-off show that is called Luxury Dark. And it's where they purchase creepy shit, supposedly, I'm going to use this in quotes, purchase creepy shit off the dark web and then talk about it on the show. And then crazy things happen. And this is where I had a really good time because they buy a killer spider and then they buy a bedworm. I'll let you try to figure out what a bedworm is. And then they buy a parasite. And each one of these feels like its own little horror short film, all shot found footage. And the ones where they got into kind of the stuff that they were buying stuff online that was always really creepy and then shit was happening. I got really into this stuff. Like there was a lot of really fun stuff. Even the stuff that they were doing with the monsters were really cool. But I at least wanted to put this on people's radar. I'm again assuming it already is. But this was definitely like 3 hours of my life on Sunday just going through all their content and finding some really interesting stuff therein of just really tight horror creators that I did not know were doing this type of thing that I really enjoyed.
There's so much stuff
Okay.
like that now that I can't eat, like because of TikTok and all these other platforms where really interesting horror content's being made that I just have no clue anymore.
Yeah, and what interested me about this is like I definitely am up on my like horror YouTubers. Like we had Dead Meat on a couple of weeks ago. Like any of the people who are really doing, you know, heavy content on horror on YouTube, more kind of like the talking head or the journalists or the critical review stuff like that. Usually they're at least on my radar enough that like I know who they are. The people who are making like this where it's fictionalized content. Even if they are pretending to be themselves, like this is Chester and Tommy, but that it is fictionalized horror content and they're churning out what is effectively like a short film every couple of days. Like it's impressive, I have to say. Like it's some of this stuff when I was looking at how regularly they were doing it, and how they were setting it up so that the scare's happening in camera. Like it was impressive. So yeah, life of luxury. Okay, take us to a movie and then I'll jump into graphic novel
Yeah,
reads.
last movie I saw is another brand new one called All You Need Is Death that I was hearing good things coming out of festivals by Paul Duane.
Have a screening link of this one and never got to it this week. Okay.
I bought this one just on Amazon. It was just popped up and I was curious about it. Very interesting, like hard to define some of it. It goes to some weird places. Irish horror. It had one of the weirdest setups that felt maybe not as weird if you're Irish, but I had never heard of this. But basically, there's a young couple who are going around trying to collect rare folks ballad songs that are Irish, especially if they're in Gaelic and they're especially if they're really old, and they're recording them, but they're also doing it like underhandedly, like they're not meant to, because maybe it's, you know, like some cultures have, oh, we pass on our language and our stories verbally and that's it, and if you don't remember it, too bad. Like that, I know that is part of certain cultures, but in this, at the start, it took a while to kind of catch up to, like, huh, and then they go to this almost like dark, some weird boardroom where they're like selling it off for to some woman who's collecting things. So it's just it, but it's in that cool collector weird. It's not the dark web, but it's the other in real world version of that. And it's pretty interesting because it's just not a world I'd seen. And they're having to translate this one song that's particularly, you know, ancient, it seems like, and some of the words translate weird. But basically, they end up finding out about some old singer who, you know, has dropped out of society. And oh yeah, you want to hear a great something juicy, go talk to her. And they track her down, and she has never sung the song to anyone. And you're not allowed to sing it to men. You're only allowed to pass it on from a woman to a woman. And
Okay, this just got
yeah,
fascinating.
and
Okay, go
she
on.
sings the song to them, but one of these people secretly record it, which they were not meant to do. And by recording it, she has broken the promise, even though she didn't break it knowingly, but she has broken the promise of the thing. And now a curse has occurred. The curse has kind of twofold. One seems to be some dark entity that is coming after her, while this other woman, basically because she says it to a man and starts decoding the language, the man becomes so obsessed and in love with her. And this is not a man that was with her. He will do anything, and basically to the point where he almost wants to consume himself. And it becomes emaciated through story. I don't want to go further than that because that's already kind of a lot, but it gets so dark and weird where it heads. Like some of it doesn't all maybe on a screenwriting level. There's moments where you're like, huh, that's a big leap, but it's so different that it makes it quite compelling and interesting. And I haven't quite seen it. And so basically ends up being the ex-girlfriend of the guy who's now obsessively in love with this older woman who was not his girlfriend. He leaves his girlfriend because this woman has said the song to him. And you're trying to decode what was being said in the song and the son of the person who told the story. So they're kind of trying to find them and track them down for the rest of the movie. Very, very just different. It's coming from XYZ. Irish film, but being distributed by XYZ. And I think for people who are looking for something quite dark, I mean, Baghead was pretty dark, but it always felt like that short film vibe. This is more dark and you don't know where it's about to head because it seems mm-hmm. quite left fieldy at times. I think you'd find it interesting. Definitely worth a watch.
Okay. That was called All You Need
All
Is
You
Death.
Need Is Death. Yeah. So a lot of good stuff this week.
Wild title. Okay. So three, I'm deep in novels, which are right behind me, which I will be hopefully discussing on next show. I'll have caught up on some of my novels. But this week, I decided to focus on graphic novels. So I reread Nice House on the Lake because DC Comics sent me this like beautiful hardback deluxe edition that is basically the entire series, start to finish. And they just announced today that they're doing Nice House on the Sea next, which is kind of the continuation, still James Tynion IV. But I got the beautiful hardback Nice House on the Lake. If for some reason you didn't pick it up when I gushed about it like a year and a half ago, pick it up now because that deluxe edition is just beautiful and it reads like butter. You can just read the whole thing straight through. And it was amazing. So the next up on my queue from Dark Horse was All Eight Eyes. Hmm. This came out November 2023. This had been sitting on my bookshelf since November 2023. And I do not know why I didn't pick this up because it's giant fucking spiders. And then I figured after Sting, which we covered last show, and then watching Infested, I was like, okay, you know what? We're just doing spiders now. So I'm going to go in with All Eight Eyes from Dark Horse. So the cold open of this is basically this guy is like meandering from a college party. He's a college student and in New York City, and he's kind of on drugs and drunk and a bunch of other things. And he sees this giant spider attack somebody in the middle of New York City. And this kind of like drifter homeless man shows up and says, these spiders are everywhere in New York City. They lurk in the dark recesses. People go missing all the time, but nobody in the city believes me that they exist. And so the college student, who's pretty aimless and has no real direction anyway, and this homeless drifter set out to figure out where these spiders are coming from and rid the city of the spiders and save people from them. And so it becomes kind of Jaws-ish, but it's their fight against these giant spiders in New York City and to get people to know that they're real. And they keep, that becomes a thing. Like people record the footage and then everybody's like, that's fake. That's totally fucking fake. And nobody believes that it's real. Or that people will see the spider and they're like, dude, you're just on fentanyl or whatever. So it becomes like a nobody actually believes that these things exist, but they crawl out from the sewers and giant spiders in New York City. This was awesome. Also taken dead seriously. It's not a comedic thing. This is a pretty serious one, but it was a lot of fun. Okay, so that was All Eight Eyes. This one is written by Steve Fox and art by Piotr Kowalski. The next up, I love this one so much. This is from Image. And this is Dark Ride. I didn't write down when this came out. I have to assume it's gotta be a stretch ago because they already have three other editions of this. Like I am late to the party on Dark Ride because I know they have, this is volume one. They have a 2 and 3 already out that I just ordered because I liked it that much. Cold open of this. This guy has this dream. This like, he has a goal in life of opening a horror theme park. Think like the theme park, like that crazy island theme park from the Scooby-Doo live action movie yeah. back from like 2000 and how we all wanted to go to like Horror Island or whatever it was called. This guy has this dream of opening that. He has a dream of opening a horror theme park. And he is there and he's sketching out the schematics and designing the roller coasters. And his wife walks in and she's like, this is a stupid dream and you're stupid from dreaming it and it's never going to come true. And he turns around and kills her. And then he's in like a fit of rage that she shit on his dream. And he's burying the body. And all of a sudden, the wife's corpse comes back to life and starts talking to him and says, "Hey, yeah, I'm not actually your wife. But you know what? I can make your dream of opening this horror theme park come true. And it will be the most popular theme park ever. And you will be incredibly successful if we can make a deal." And you realize then that the devil has animated his wife's corpse and he has just sold his soul to open this horror theme park. And then we flash forward, like that was like 50 years ago. We flash forward and he is now older. He has created the world's most successful theme park. It is completely horror themed. He's got two now adult kids who are both kind of celebrities in their own right because he became so popular and made so much money. His son is like a high powered business executive and his daughter's basically like a Paris Hilton type influencer. And they're kind of battling over power within the park. And at the same time, you realize that the devil is kind of lurking around, eventually coming for him. And it's also kind of picking off souls from the park. This was so cool. Like, I want this park to exist in real life, but the way that the demon was kind of taking souls from the park was also really cool. This is Joshua Williamson, who wrote Nailbiter, which is just an absolutely amazing true crime graphic novel from a number of years ago, and art by Andre Bresson, who did Birthright. So fun. I cannot wait to read the other two editions. That was Dark Ride.
Can you tomorrow remember? I really want to read, borrow from you, Night of the Ghoul. I really want to.
Night
could
of the
you
Ghoul.
Bring that
yep.
tomorrow night at the movie we're going to? Because I really want to see that, read that one.
You got it.
That's how we make our deals live on air. Boom.
You got it. I can do that. Okay, so let's talk about Abigail. And I will say, we are recording this little segment separate from the rest of our show. It is bright and early, 8:37 in the morning here, the morning after we have seen it on Thursday morning. And we wanted to make sure that we got this little segment in because we were really excited to talk about Abigail and wanted to make sure we timed it with the release.
And no spoilers, so don't freak out. We won't spoil anything that wasn't, you know, up front in the trailer. We just wanted to do a quick enthusiasm burst because, you know, Radio Silence always make fun movies, I think. Mm-hmm. I'm maybe less in the bag for the Scream ones. I think they're fine. Like, they don't totally excite me.
Yeah, that's fun. Kind of the thing is, I'm like, you know, they're... I consider their Scream films to be, especially the last one, it was very ephemeral. Like while I was in there, I was like, yeah, this is great. This is fun. And then if you'd asked me what the plot was 2 days later, I was like, I think they made a store at the end or like a museum. Like that's all I got. I can't remember a damn thing else. But
yeah, part of the problem has been like when you try to keep a great cast together or a fun young cast like they do, this no one's dying in the movie in the second one. And I'm just like, it felt like everyone's through. Anyway, I have some issues. I think Radio Nuts a lot of fun, but I have some like this. Some things about it that leave me a little cold at times, but there's some really fun big moments. For me, this was the most fun movie they've made. Like I really
loved this. It was
I think so funny.
I may have enjoyed Ready or Not a little bit more, but I'll talk about that momentarily, kind of like my only issue with this one that I did not think that Ready or Not had. But that said, this was a blast to the point that I'm considering going back and seeing it again this weekend.
Yeah, I think the standout thing for me was that this is a fantastic, like everyone knows, if you listen to this, you know, my taste strays more towards like the art house type side of horror or whatever. But this is the kind of movie that I want when I go to a big movie because it's A, it's goopy and over the top and big, but also these characters are so fun, even though they're like shorthand types from other films, right?
They're total caricatures. They are total caricatures.
But they're not played that way. So they set up like that. Like you have the driver and you have the muscle and you think, and then it's all kind of looking behind the curtain of that. And the casting makes this movie, I think it's one of the best young casts I've seen in a movie in a very long time. I mean, at least since Love Lies Bleeding is the other great cast this year, I think. But Dan Stevens is so much fun to watch in this. Catherine Newton is killing it. And the guy from Guillermo del Toro's The Strain, the TV show.
Kevin Durant
steals the
movie.
Wait,
he's the big guy. He's
the
muscle.
Big guy.
Yeah.
He's freaking hilarious in this movie. And obviously the young girl's fantastic. So I just think the kind of the gags and the characters, the way they keep unfolding, the setup, obviously, if you watch the anyone who's going into this will know that this is a vampire film. That part's clear.
Yeah, I think vampire ballerina is like screamed in the trailer. She even says a vampire ballerina in the
which
trailer.
Which is a great line.
I think we're safe on that.
I was shocked that in the movie that line didn't. It was like they rushed the next thing so it didn't get the laugh.
It
deserves because it really is a fantastic delivery and the trailer shows it off. But
yeah, I think the setup, in case you have not seen the trailer, is we can say that because that is in the trailer, is a group of kind of hired guns. They're kind of collected as a team, are hired to kidnap this incredibly wealthy man's daughter with the intent of, you know, getting money from him, of trying to, hold her hostage and extort the money from him. And what they find very quickly is that she's a vampire and she also really likes ballet. And that is crystal clear in the trailer. So
yeah, no, up to the point where they're trapped. I mean, up to the point where it's like now they're stuck and what happens next. And there are still some fun little twists along the way. I can only imagine, though, I was thinking about it. I was like, oh my God, how cool would this movie have been if somebody took you to it and you had never heard of it, you never saw a trailer, there's no way you would see where it was going. Like, you would have zero content. It would be the coolest thing. I think the only time I've done that is Cabin in the Woods. I saw the first screening ever of that at South By, and it was the coolest experience with no knowledge of it.
I've had a couple of those, but it's always been ones that were on a smaller indie scale, like Red, White, and Blue. I remember seeing, nothing about any of the twists and then being like, what the fuck? And things like that. But yeah, it's always been smaller stuff. But this one, I mean, there's literally a vampire ballerina on the poster. So you know what you're getting into. That said, the twist still punches and there's other twists along the way and across the board. It's really fun. My only gripe after I slept on it for a night was that I felt like the third act I would have trimmed. I would have cut slightly just because it seemed like, a solid hour of action in the third act, which was great. It was fun, but I would have trimmed a little bit. But that said, that's like my only thing. And that's the thing that made me say like, okay, Ready or Not, like I felt the pacing was awesome. So,
yeah, I mean, there's a character you can feel more for in Ready or Not. I mean, the Melissa Barrera is actually the most I've ever liked her in any of these movies in this film.
I admittedly was not a huge fan of her in the Scream films, but I really liked her in this. So, yeah, it worked like a charm. So I hope
really fun cast,
gangbusters this weekend. I really do.
Yeah, again, this is the kind of, and I would also say, even though it's really goopy and has, horror in it, this is also a great film that somebody could take like a younger sibling or a kid to, because I just think the fun level would be understandable. And there's nothing ridiculously inappropriate.
There's nothing. Yeah, it's a lot of blood. It is a lot of blood. But that said, like, I plan to take my kid. And there were kids in the theater when we saw it last night at the big premiere screening last night. There were, preteens in the theater with us, so who seemed totally into it. A lot of blood, nothing really past that. So,
and I think Catherine Newton is definitely getting her like horror queen card right now. Like, she's freaking hilarious in everything she's been in so far. So, got to keep tracking her. But anyway, fantastic cast, really fun movie. Definitely go see it this weekend if you can. That's why we wanted to include this before.
100%. Go see it while it's in the theater. It is a big theatrical movie, worth it. So go check out Abigail.
And then go home and to get Shudder and watch Livid and Dracula's Daughter. Let's make sure that these two movies still get some love.
Yeah. We actually had a discussion standing in line last night if this was an officially licensed kind of wink at Livid or if they're just winking at Livid, because Livid is a French film that came out, it's probably been 10 years, that was also about a vampire ballerina girl. And
a
home invasion. Yeah, it's
a very different tone.
Very different tone, kind of similar plot, and kind of, the hook is similar. And so that was optioned by the Weinsteins as soon as it came out in France and played here with the intention of a remake. And then when everything went down at Weinsteins, I have no idea what happened to it. But this had the same hook, to the point that it was making me say, like, did they license Livid and just turn it into this? Or is this just winking at it? I don't know.
I watched
Livid too.
Yeah, I looked just now on their trivia page and there was no mention of Livid yet. So I feel like it would have been there if they had had something. But yeah, it's interesting. But I think they also mention a vampire ballerina in Cabin in the Woods, but it's not seen. So Who knows what, but maybe we'll find out on the press tour.
Yeah.
There you go.
But
go check it out in theaters.
Go see Abigail in theaters this weekend.
When we come back, we are going to use our first omen to explore some religious horrors as a kind of a draft. Not really about blocking films, more like making a list of 10 together. But we wanted to dive into some religious horror because I think there's some interesting reasons for this is on the rise in some way. So let's discuss in a second.
You going down, Kane. This week's episode of Colors of the Dark is also brought to you by Welgo USA's latest creature feature horror, Sting, in theaters everywhere on April 12th. Sting spins a web of thrilling terror when a 12-year-old girl, Charlotte's pet spider, rapidly transforms into a flesh-eating giant monster, forcing the young girl to fight for her family's survival. Directed by Kaya Roche Turner and starring Ryan Kaur, Isla Brown, Penelope Mitchell, and Jermaine Fowler. Brace yourself for a crazy eight-legged nightmare that will keep you on the edge of your seat. Don't miss Sting, exclusively in theaters April 12th.
Okay, in a month where Immaculate and First Omen went back-to-back, which is just one of the wildest things I think that's happened in a while, it seemed like it was a sign from the heavens for us to do some sort of religious conversation, religious horror draft, we're going to call it in this case, but not, it's not a big, we're not trying to block each other. It's not going to be gamified so much. And you can if you really want it.
Was this is not supposed to be the best religious horrors. This is supposed
I think this is just your favorites. Some are going to be
our
the best.
Fave. Like we're counting down our 10 faves.
This is 10. This is 10 movies that like we've got five each. We're going to place it in order, build it from 10 to 1. We are taking off the table two movies. One is The Exorcist, for obvious reasons.
And all Exorcist sequels as well.
Oh, you can. Yeah, that's fine. Like, I didn't include one, but that makes sense.
I mean, I would have put Exorcist 3 in there because I admittedly like 3 more than 1, which I know is a bold horror statement. But yeah, so I didn't include any Exorcist or The Devils was the other one that we said. It's
The
too
Devils
obvious.
And it's luckily just come back into the conversation so people are able to watch it on the Criterion channel and not for much longer. I think it's about to disappear again. But the fact that it is you just can't touch it. It's as good as a movie like that can get. And they're from very different eras in terms of especially the time periods they're portraying.
Mm-hmm.
I think, so the interesting thing about this question right now before we start talking about the movies is the why. Because I am very fascinated by the fact that we are at a moment in time where faith has never been this much on the wane in Western culture and Christian. And again, a lot of these become Christian. Well, the numbers of churches are like dwindling from like they're surging for very specific types of churches. Right. But the mainstream Christianity, like never. I mean, if you look at censuses from around the world, it's just like unbelievable how much the numbers, because people like me I was raised in the church. I don't go to church. Mm-mm. I was raised in the church with a stepdad who's a minister and an entire family. Not one of us, not one of five children who came out of that family is religious, or not saying we're not religious, but we're not practicing at a church. That is fascinating. But yet movies portraying faith and religion and the supernatural seem to be kind of booming. And maybe it's the search for needing something like that. I don't know.
You know, I feel like we had the same thing in the 1960s. Because as I was just a couple of weeks ago for Fangoria, I wrote the history of the nun films. And it reminded me that in the 1960s, there was this massive, massive drop in attendance in Catholic churches. It was mostly just Catholic churches. And it was because the 60s were all about kind of rethinking society and women's place and things like that. And a lot of people dropped out of Catholicism because it was suddenly like, wait, we can't take communion if we're divorced. Wait, what about the women? Wait, what about babies? Like birth control is not a thing. So the Catholic Church kind of reshaped a lot of their doctrine in the late 1960s into the early 70s as an attempt to try to get their numbers back up. And it worked. It did work that they kind of loosened their, you know, grip on some of the more stringent doctrine that people were really fighting against in the 1960s. As this was going down, it reminded me that a lot of what we have at the tail end of the 60s into the early 1970s, including Rosemary's Baby and The Exorcist, are religious horrors. And so it was right at that moment that the church was losing a grasp that we see these religious horror films come out as well. Because that's right when we saw the peak nun films was like right as the Catholic Church was really kind of falling apart. Their numbers dropped by ridiculous amounts during that time. So, yeah.
But then a movie like Exorcist, but then it scares people back to the church.
Does it?
Exorcist. I think Exorcist, when it was released.
I assume that it was them saying, like, we're not going to ask any questions about your birth control would have done that.
No, I mean, there's a whole bunch of societal reasons. But I think in terms of movies, I think one of the most fascinating things, especially like Satanic Panic, right? The church being against things like horror movies and things that embrace Satan. I think they need to go the complete opposite way, because when I was thinking about this, I was like, nothing embraces religious Christian, not just values, but the concepts like horror films. Mm-hmm. Horror films are literally telling all of the people who are religious that what you believe in is accurate.
We fight the devil constantly.
Yeah, if there's a devil and it's a good versus evil, then we are literally confirming your stories and your beliefs. So shouldn't they be pushing hard? Like why are religious film studios making Kirk Cameron movies when they could literally be making horror movies that would scare people to the church? I'm like, come on, guys. I want to see a new wave of religious horror movies made by religious people trying to get us back in. Because I think the more sacrilegious thing to do is to, when you make one of these films where the darkness wins. That, like, there are obviously less horror films. A lot of horror films, darkness wins or the character dies, mm-hmm. but less than overcoming it. That does seem more like, oh, there is no hope. It's a more of a sacrilege point of view. But I find it very, I'm very curious, but I've never thought about it until this week. Yeah. I was like, yeah, wait, why are religious, you know, churches against these are just movies after all. And they really, it's stories that are very in line with biblical teachings. So kind of interesting.
You know, I have family members that are so Christian that they won't speak to me. I'm not kidding. Like, this is some trauma. Yeah. I'll probably work out on a future episode or not. I'll just keep bottling that shit up and make it a pain in my neck that hurts, you know, every couple of days where I'm like, my neck's doing that thing again. I call that my aunt and uncle.
Because of being a redhead.
Being a redhead witch. Yeah.
That's being a redhead. That's a strong reaction.
Outright refused to come to my graduation, wouldn't come to my wedding. Like, have always just said I'm the satanic child because I watch horror movies. And so it's been a whole thing within the family, but that's what I always told them is like, we fight the devil like every day, but
every movie. But you're confirming the devil exists by fighting the devil. So
but
it's
I'm
like,
not going to church, and half the time in those movies, I'm kind of rooting for the devil, admittedly. So there you go.
Interesting.
But this also got me into questioning, what is a religious horror? Like, what is the criteria? Because if you just type in religious horror into Google, you are going to be met with this Wikipedia list of every supposed religious horror film. It's alphabetized. You can look through it. And it lists a lot of zombie films. It lists demons, like Mario Bava's demons. And I'm like,
yeah, I don't think of that.
You know, those have demons.
I mean, some might have iconography that we forget.
That's kind of it. I was like, well, there's demons, but there's not angels, and there's no devil, and there's no church. And I don't know if I consider that a religious horror as much as more of kind of a monster movie.
I stayed away from, I tried to stay away from like mostly folk horror, because obviously when we're talking about religion, we're also coming off Immaculum First Omen, so not to offend anyone else, you know, there's so many different types of religions out there. I think it's really the kind of Christian, Catholic, the kind of religions that have been popular in Western culture, because that's been the dominant Hollywood mode.
Yeah.
You know, but there are, we could obviously do a whole different draft on like other types of religions and folk horror beliefs and Satanism and cults, and that there's just so many. So I think most of mine, one of them is a little mixture, but mostly I was looking at things from there, and I'm not as in the bag as you are for the, like, this is definitely something I tend to think of you.
A I subgenre love religious horrors.
Yeah. I think the ones I've got on this list are ones, especially later, are some of my just favorite movies, but they all do something that's not as typical as, you know, some of the, what's Stigmatas, and there's so many movies where that are fun and I have no problem with them, but they don't tend to be what I'm drawn to in horror.
Yeah.
They don't tend to be the thing that I'm most excited to go see. That's why I'm, to be honest, surprised how much I liked Immaculate and First Omen this year.
These are the ones I'm excited to most see. Like, we're going to see The Strangers. I'm like, cool. Yeah. I'm going to put popcorn in my face and still get excited. But if you tell me it's like some new religious horror film or like a possession movie or something like that. Like those are definitely more my jam. So those are the ones that I'm want to go see. Okay, you want to kick us off at 10?
Yeah, I think mine deserves to be at number 10.
Oh, exactly. I have a total 10. I mean, that's what's happening here.
Once we get to the top, we'll fight over which one goes number one.
Okay, okay.
That's how we'll finish our list. Number 10 for me is when I rewatched it because it was an absolute favorite of mine when I was a kid. Of all the religious films, this was my favorite one. I rented on Vestron Video, and I hadn't seen it since I was a kid.
Oh, shit, it's on my list as well. If it's a Vestron Video one, I'm going to have to be rewriting my list while we go.
Is it The Unholy?
It is The Unholy with the hot-ass redhead who turns into, like, the weird devil dog, and then he takes communion, but it's, like, a scale off her back. I don't even know what the fuck was going on there, but great movie.
And really been unfortunate. Like, Vestron Video had that little release a few years back, maybe 10, mm-hmm. 8 years ago, when we were doing Killer POV when they came out. But a lot of them have fallen back into out of print. So this movie was so hard to even get to rewatch it.
Yep.
I had to ask multiple friends because I forgot to buy it. But I was like a big fan of this as a kid. Like, this is one of those weird movies I rented from the video store and was like quite obviously the nudity is very, you know, it's a demon. Basically, it's the idea there is a church in New Orleans where priests are basically in the opening scene. A priest is being seduced by a redhead woman, totally nude, dancing in front of him. As soon as he starts kissing, she murders him in a really grotesque way. And so in the act of sinning, all these different priests are being killed. And the diocese calls in. There's a couple of fun, like, it's who is it? It's Hal Holbrook mm-hmm. is one of the priests, and then the old British actor who's always great, Trevor Howard, you know, is blind, kind of like with the white eyes. And they're like, there's one other guy. I believe he's going to be the chosen one to take on this battle. And when we meet this young, cooler looking priest, played by a guy I wasn't familiar with, Ben Cross, and he is he's standing on there's a jumper on a ledge when we first meet him, and some guy's about to jump because he's having these same visions so he says, and this priest talks to him, and when he touches the guy to try to stop him, the guy looks like a crazy demon and then pushes the priest off this huge building, and the priest wakes up and he hasn't got a scratch on him. This is like the backstory, essentially, and he's come through somehow, and now the church is like, sure, he's the one that they're going to try to seduce next, and if they seduce him, then this demon will have be winning in this war against God. And so it's all set in the iconography of the church, but there's something very sexual, very sleazy. But in the last act, it's not a great movie. It's a very fun movie. Like, I really dig it. But in the last act, it really is awesome because it's like pure 80s Vestron. Like, literally, this beautiful woman turns into, like, it reminded me of The Creatures in the Gate, but way bigger.
Mm-hmm.
And like demon dog thing,
the
mixed
demon
with
dog
weird
thing,
ghoulie,
yeah,
you know, and they're running around trying
all
to
little ghoulies like, that like show up to like help them. It's wild.
It's just like one of those very unexpected turns, and the effects are fun. The effects are the best thing in it, probably. But I really recommend it because I feel like this one's lesser known. But when I was young, this really was the one that I dug of the subgenre, mm-hmm. and for years it's been tricky to see. So that's my number 10. Really my number 5, but 10 altogether.
Okay,
I'm glad it was on yours, so it stays.
Yeah.
There will be no blocking.
I've had to sub because I would have had that a smidge higher, but I've got,
we might have a couple
have
of
backups.
Those
might, I have backups that, yeah. Okay, for number 9, The Devil's Daughter, aka The Sect, from 1991. You've never seen
The Sect. The Devil's Daughter, there's another movie.
There's one with a similar title that I may
Michelle
or may
Sarvi.
Not put. This is Michelle Soavi. So The Devil's Daughter, aka The Sect, aka, like, when it came out in the US, a lot of them had the VHS title La Setta, which is The Sect.
That's right.
1991, and this is produced by Dario Argento, but it's directed by Michelle Soavi, who honestly I consider to be one of the most amazing Italian directors. Stage Fright, The Church, like, he's just got
when it
bangers.
Comes to atmosphere that he's one of the leaders,
yeah.
I think.
So this one, it's got a killer cold open scene where we are in California, and it's this like group of hippies in like the late 60s, early 70s, and this guy shows up and he's like, I'm traveling, I'm a drifter, and they're like, come sit down with us, brother, have food. He hangs out, he sleeps there overnight, wakes up in the middle of the night, ritually kills all of them in the name of Lucifer. And that's kind of our cold open. Now we flash forward to what is supposed to be present day. It's like 1990s Germany. And we are following around a woman While all of these other killings are kind of happening around, but she is a school teacher and she accidentally hits this elderly man with her car. And so we're in like a completely different movie now, as this school teacher in Germany hits this elderly man with her car. And basically she takes him home because she doesn't know what else to do. And she feels bad for hitting him with her car. She takes him home, lets her sleep there. And then you realize really quickly that he's part of this satanic sect, and that he intentionally targeted her because she's in somehow affiliated. And so this movie, it just keeps double back on itself multiple times. Honestly, like most Italian films, the plot gets a little wonky at varying points where I'm like, I don't really know what's happening here. There's something happening with a beetle. But Soavi, amazing with atmosphere. And some of the scenes in this, there's this scene where they take off a guy's skin and they put it on a tree, and then it forms this like mask, and it's crazy, crazy effects that happen in this one. So I love this movie so much. Goes, and much like, you know, Immaculate or First Omen, you find out pretty quickly that she is supposed to give birth to the Antichrist, that she has been targeted by the satanic sect because she has been the chosen one to give birth to the Antichrist. And so she's now kind of caught up in all this, and it's awesome. So yeah, anyways, you definitely need to check this one out if you have not already seen this. There's an absolutely beautiful Blu-ray out on this. I can't remember who did it. It feels like a
Severin. I think
Severin.
It's Severin.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I saw this before this ever went, and it wasn't the best copy, so I'd love to see it again.
Yeah, this feels like a Severin release, so I'm going to guess it's them.
All right, so at number 8, I will be playing a movie that I watched. I'd seen it once before a long time ago, and I rewatched it yesterday, and it was so much fun. And that is, I needed a nun film, and boy, do I have it. School of the Holy
Love
Beast.
This one. Oh my God, this is such a fucked up
so
movie.
So fun. A.K.A. The Transgressor. First, it has Yumi Takagawa from Female Prisoner Scorpion 701, and she is just ridiculously hot. Like, so it basically opens with her, and she's just wandering around the, like, busy Tokyo and looking hot, and just like gets on some dude's motorbike who she's never met, goes back to his house, has sex with him, and then looks over at him and goes, well, this is the last time I'll be having fun for a while. And then cuts to her entering a covenant because she knew this was the last moment of kind of pleasure she would have. She enters the covenant, which is just, I had to take a moment and like research, and I'm like, yeah, Catholicism was not a thing in Japan at all. And so this was purely done because, you know, these movies were popular. There was like almost zero.
Yeah, what it was is we had a lot of missionaries kind of traipsing through Japan. So I think that was a lot of the connotation was like these missionaries, these like weirdo people kind of, you know, hitchhiking through Japan trying to convert everybody.
I mean, it could be, but I think this director, Suzuki, the director, is just like, oh, these films are popular.
Yeah, let's
do it in
this.
Japan. And but they do it so much better because I think the style of these, there's just some other nun movies I watch. They're like, oh, they're cool movies, Italian ones, but they weren't stylish in this way. And this is so beautifully made that I think when you're doing perversion, but you're doing it beautifully shot, like almost Pinku style, it's just the best. And so what's cool, it actually has a really good story. She gets in there. You don't know what the story is for quite a while, but she's in there and you start seeing all the bullshit, you know, complexities and hypocrisies of the church and the way these, you know, senior nuns treat everyone. And there's perversions and there's obviously lesbian nuns and all the things that you would expect to see in a good nunsploitation.
I remember there being acid in this too. Is there like acid?
Somebody takes something. There's definitely a couple very interesting.
Not acid like you take, like they have acid like liquid,
oh, yes,
and they're like flinging it at people.
There's a thing where somebody is like burnt into a pit of it, basically.
That's it. Okay.
It's actually really cool. I'd forgotten about that. Yeah. So, but basically what you find out, her name tag falls at one point and somebody recognizes her name and kind of gets all worried. It turns out she never knew her mother because her mother died in this convent after giving birth to her as a baby. And then she was given up. She has no clue who her father is. And so she's here to she wasn't here to join the church. She's here secretly investigating the death of her mother in this thing and trying to piece it together. And then you meet this main priest who comes and visits every once in a while, who looks like Rasputin. And it's pretty wild where the story goes, and they're in the last act. I would say it's not really a horror film, especially in the first two thirds. It's much more of an exploitation film, but in the last act, it's somewhere in between. There's enough horror grotesqueries, none on none. It's like got moments that literally feel like they took Black Narcissus and said, yeah, but now let's push that even crazier. And it is so much fun. It's one of the most fun rewatches I've had in a while. I had a blast watching this movie, and I was like, this has to be on this list. School of the Holy Beast, don't miss it. It's sexy, fun, grotesque. It's got all the good stuff.
Love this one so much. This is a really hard one to find. It used to be on a box set for a really long time,
Yeah,
and
they might, maybe there's still the DVD of
yeah.
it. I'm not sure
No,
if it's
this was
streaming.
great. Okay, I'm going to take us a little bit more contemporary. This is one that I actually talked about on Colors a number of years ago when it came out and just totally proselytized the hell out of it. And that is Hellhole from 2022. This
Oh,
is
yeah.
a Polish film, also known as The Last Supper. And this snuck onto Netflix at some point, and I watched it, and I was just so enamored with this film because it breaks rules of kind of scripting multiple times, and it reinvents itself a couple times throughout. And I just found it to be such a fun ride throughout. So this is still on
Wait, how
Netflix,
recent was this?
2022.
Oh, okay. I've seen the picture of this.
Yeah,
Yeah,
on
I haven't seen
Netflix.
this one.
It's a
Okay, yeah.
fun movie. It's grotesque, but it's fun. So a priest in, I believe it's supposed to be the 80s, takes a position at a sanatorium where women are brought in to have exorcisms. And the priest there, it's this monastery, but their main thing that the monastery does is they bring these women in who are thought to have possessions, and they keep some of them there, but then other ones they pretend to exorcise. But you quickly find out, he's been assigned to work here, that they basically lose as many patients as they save. Like, they have a real high death rate, and they're like, oh, well, everybody's insane, and they're possessed by the devil and shit happens. And so you realize real quickly that they're not having a real good success rate with this. And half the priests don't believe. They're like, we don't even know if this is doing anything. But the priest who has just come there, who is just visiting, and has just been assigned there, he starts to experience this kind of like supernatural stuff in his room. Like, he starts hearing noises and things are moving, and his mirror cracks. And at the same time, he's going back and forth with these exorcisms, and the whole monastery feels off. Like, he begins to suspect that something is happening. Like, what's happening to these women? And he starts doing investigating, and it keeps getting creepier and creepier and creepier. And this one's recent enough that I won't say where it goes, but this was such a fun ride of where it goes to. It is like an Immaculate, but for monks, and how it kind of goes at the end and then breaks kind of the rules of horror at the climax. I really enjoyed this one. So, Polish Netflix, called Hellhole from 2022. Or actually, it might
That
be
would be
2020. It was 2020, it was made, it was released to Netflix in 2022.
and that's number 7 on our list
That
right here,
is
right?
number seven on our list.
Okay, number 6. I had have to play it. We've talked about it a number of times in a number of different episodes, but it's one of my favorite movies. I think we talked about it in one things we'd remake, and that is The Sentinel, Michael Winner, 1977. I think one of the best uses of the concept of the Catholic Church. Fashion model, especially the fashion model side of it, in a sense, is trying to get into a house that's very a brownstone in New York that's very difficult. Somebody gets her in. She starts meeting all these weird neighbors. Weird things start happening, and we come to learn there's a priest up, a blind priest played by John Carradine upstairs who's always looking out the window. And as the movie unfolds, we come to learn that there is a gate to hell, and the Catholic Church and this person who's been chosen to be the sentinel is the thing to watch after it. And what I like is the idea. In a way, it's actually quite a good Catholic film because it's about her character who, being a fashion model, and you represent all the frivolous kind of ideas of modernity, right? Like being beautiful and being out and single and dressing well, and to give all of that up to save people to live this monastic life. It's a very entertaining horror film, but at its core, it's actually pretty devout when you think about it. Really cool movie. Just a great horror film that people, I'm sure, there are still some who haven't seen this one. And you got to watch it. So it had to be on the list.
Okay, number five. I love The Sentinel, by the way. The cat birthday party every time. That's how
All
your
time, yeah.
birthday party is going to look on Friday, by the way. I hope
I'm
you're
doing it with
prepared
two
for
cats right
two
now.
cats. That's it. Are your cats? I haven't seen them in forever.
One of them's huge. I don't know
Lego.
how it's even possible. Lego's the little skinny one. The other one is like 5 times the size of that cat, and she's can always trying to be near me every second. If I sit
Aww.
down, she will walk up and wants my hand on her Padding hurts
Well,
hilarious,
Kippy
but
likes them, your dog, right?
he hates one of them.
I
They
was
have
gonna say, does he curl up with the cats and sleep?
Oh, and one of them he's fine, but the other one he's always like chasing. They've always got like the two males, basically, the male cat and the
Aww.
male dog.
Okay.
So
Kitties aside,
yeah,
okay,
right.
moving forward on to number five. And I am going to go with Satan's Slaves from 2017.
Oh
This is
yeah,
another
brilliant.
recent one for me. I even considered putting the original Satan's Slaves from 1981 on, but admittedly, I think the 2017, it's Joko Anwar. It fucking is scary. Like, it is a scary film. I actually used to show this in my summer class at USC, my horror summer class, where I was talking about how to craft out scares. This is one of the ones that I would show because I feel like some of the horror sequences in this punch so hard. So based off a 1980 film that I'll talk about in a sec, it follows a death of a woman who used to be a singer. And she is very wealthy. She has this massive estate, and she dies after basically several years of being debilitated and having this really strange illness that nobody could figure out. But she has just passed away, and her entire family, there's like six of them, have shown up to try to figure out, to do her her funeral, to do the wake, and then specifically to kind of divide up her financials and her royalties from her long career and things like that. And we get there as the mom is kind of ill and bedridden and about to die. And so everybody kind of arrives right as she's passing away. And it's this whole like six person family rolls in. And really quickly, they realize that something is happening in the house, that they're all staying there while they're trying to sort out the will and who gets the royalties to her music, but that there is something seriously fucked up happening in the house. And you realize that mom may had made some bargains while she was still alive and affiliated with a satanic church. And it gets really messed up. Like, this one is shockingly how crazy, how messed up it gets. The original 1981, it's good. Severin did a re-release of it recently. It's good. It is not as scary as the first one. It's definitely as this one, as the 2017. It's definitely made on a shoestring budget. But what I found fascinating about the 1980 version is whereas this one kind of clings pretty heavily to the Christian faith, the 1981 in Indonesia at the time, the country was split half between Muslim and Christianity. And so it brings in both of them. Like, it really brings both of them into the supernatural stuff that's happening in the 1980s version. So I really like that. But straight scares. Religious horror all the way. Satan Slaves 2017. It's on Shudder right now.
Yeah, I like this one too. We're up to number four.
Four.
This could also easily be number one. I think it's one of the best religious horrors ever, but I have one thing I like more. This is the rare case. Most of these movies, when we talk about religion and horror, I'd say 90% of them have a supernatural element because of the very fact that it's often devil versus God kind of stuff. But there's some cases where it's not, and I really take to those. And this is the classic Alice, Sweet Alice. AKA Communion. I think if they
Had
had
it
named
on
it
my list
Communion,
as well.
I think if they'd stuck with Communion, I would have given it the number one. They, because of their wimping out and calling it Alice, Sweet Alice, I have to drop them a couple beats. This is one of the coolest movies, a slasher film. And what I love about it most is it's a 1976 film that's a 1961 period piece. And I find that to be because Alfred Solé was obviously a production designer, so he could do that, but it really adds something to the way the film feels. I think it's just one of the best atmosphere. It's obviously a, more or less an American giallo, but it the fact that it is like a couple who are already struggling, you know, a divorced Catholic couple at the church with their two daughters, and one of their daughters is killed at a holy first Holy Communion, and then the other daughter becomes the suspect in these killings, and more people start to die. It has a great, I think, the church being responsible for the pressure on sin and things like this. The pressure on these families is a big part of why this works so well. And I love the two, the girl, you know, Linda Miller and Polly Shepherd. They're, you know, so good in this film, and I just love that it's a non-supernatural, but also a period film. There's something very unique about that. Great, great movie. Could be number one for like for real. Like this is that good.
Okay, I love that one too, and was on my list. I had that a little bit lower, but I'll totally accept it at four. At three, this is kind of a bolder swing, but God, I loved this movie when it came out. I wanted to include an exorcism movie. I wanted to
It
include
better
one.
not be the one that ends with a website
No, no.
thing. Otherwise, I'm going to quit this
This
draft.
Was a couple of years before that one.
Okay.
This is The Last Exorcism from 2010. This
Oh, the
is
Eli Roth
Daniel
one?
Stamm found footage film.
I think Eli Roth produced it.
Okay, he may have. I remember seeing this at Comic-Con in 2010. And the setup is that it's an evangelical minister who claims, and it's real, like rural, I think it's Louisiana. He claims that his daughter is possessed by the devil. And he lets a documentary crew come film as he starts to take her through the process of exorcism and deal with his possessed daughter. And the documentary crew immediately starts to think that this isn't an exorcism, that the daughter just has like some mental problems because she's been heavily abused and everything he is doing is continued child abuse. And then as it goes, you realize that there is something much, much worse going on. I remember this being awesome. And I rewatched it a couple of years ago and really loved it as well. But I'm looking at the reviews now. When this came out, this got great reviews. But all of the recent stuff from the past couple of years has been like, this sucks. It's not scary. And I don't even know what to say. Like, I thought this was such a tight exorcism movie.
Is this Ashley Bell as the possessed
girl? Ashley Bell,
really,
and it's got Caleb Landry Jones. This is one of his first roles. He plays her older brother in it, and I just remember finding this movie to be great and well directed. It was very much part of the found footage craze. Like, we're at like the Paranormal Activity found footage craze, so it might be getting some kickback from that, but I found this just to be a really fun PG-13 movie that it worked. It worked when I saw it, and it worked when I watched it a couple of years ago. So The Last Exorcism.
I bet some people have totally missed it
just
because of when it came out. I remember liking it. I would have to see it again to think how I feel now about it, but I did think it was like cool to do one that way.
Yeah.
It made sense. Like, and the found footage.
It totally worked.
This is my last pick. I have what I think should objectively be a number one that we'll do afterwards. We'll see what ends up at number one. But this is my personal favorite movie that has anything to do with the church. This is growing to become like just a personal favorite of this director. And it's the first, because there's a new documentary on Kim's Video that has come in theaters right now. I'm very excited to see it because it's all about rediscovering the films and stuff. But the first film I went when visiting New York to Kim's that I couldn't get anywhere else, I bought it on VHS and I was so excited to take it back to New Zealand. And that is Don't Torture a Duckling,
which
I think has one of the most searing fuck yous to the Catholic Church I've ever seen put on screen. I feel like this is almost a dangerous movie by Fulci because he's pretty merciless at this and superstition and small town. This is like what they would call maybe Southern Italian filmmaking versus most that we watch are Northern. Most are set in the cities. This is about the rural town and the superstition that shrouds the mystery of the church and how everyone kind of deifies like priests. And of course, without giving too much away, that doesn't always work out, but this is about child murders in this small town and it is really effective. And it's also Barbara Brichet's in this and ridiculously sexy, you know, and half the time she's naked walking around while young boys are like, oh my God. And there's one scene that I always wondered about. I only learned about it today, which I have to share. There's always one scene where she was basically nude holding a tray and she's walking towards the young boy. And I remember while I was watching it thinking, man, I guess this kind of stuff is okay to show in Italy because this would basically be like, I just don't know how you could film this because it's so, you know, on that line because this is a real kid. It's not a person pretending to be a kid. And today I read about it that Fulci was arrested for the scene and he was taken to court and he had to prove for child endangerment. I never knew this until today. And it turns out he could prove through how they filmed it. They filmed the two people were never in the same room.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, the nude person was never in the room. They were shot singularly, shot the kid and put it together. But he was actually arrested for this, which is just funny because in Italy at this time, I feel like so much crazy shit. We start to feel like there were no rules. So we just assume like, yeah, I guess everything was up for grabs. But maybe kids were still aligned, thankfully, in their movies. But I was today old when I learned that Fulci was arrested at some point for this. We all know Ruggero Deodato for Cannibal Holocaust, but that's a whole different thing. But this movie is really something. And it's like the kind of movie, if you haven't seen it for a few years, you go back to and you start to realize maybe this is Fulci's best movie because it's got all the good stuff that we love in a Fulci movie, but there's something mature and like he's really saying something and he seems angry. And I think he's channeling that into a movie that's the Florinda Balkan role in this. And I was tweeting about her a couple of days ago because I had just watched Flavia the Heretic for the first time,
and
I know
you're
a fan.
Flavia, yeah.
I had never seen it, and I watched that for
what
the show, and I was like,
"What
a great
watch, Flavia."
Oh, this show, this episode. Okay. Like, I was looking at some nun ones. I watched that in Holy Beast back to back, and I was
pretty
like,
"Pretty fucking brutal." It's considered to be one of the most brutal ones. It's got, like,
I think it'd
flaying.
Be good. At the end, it's very, a very grotesque image. It would be a good pairing with the Devils because of the time period, I think. But she's so good in all these movies. And this is one where she's just really emotional. Like, you feel for her. She's someone who's lost a kid, and you just see the searing thing. It's got a fucking crazy ending, crazy score. It's a brilliant, brilliant movie. And I think a lot of people forget just how really about the church this movie is. It's perfect religious horror, but don't show your duckling.
Now I have to sidebar on Flavia briefly. This will not be my number one, but holy shit, I'm so glad that you watched that. I loved that one for the longest time because she starts out in the Catholic Church as a nun and realizes how repressed women are. And then she's like, I'm going to go have sex with these Muslims over here. And so she hooks up with a Muslim guy and is like, oh God, you guys are just as horrible to women. And then she just kind of goes rogue and ends
for a while.
In jail.
Unfortunately, it doesn't go well by the end. It's quite a brutal instinct. She is really a deeply underrated. She's actually Brazilian, but she's in Your Beloved. The main one I always think of her as Fulci's Lizard in a Woman's Skin.
Because
that's a performance. She's just always in these roles where she's always beautiful and almost she holds it all in really well, but she gets to go kind of wild by the end. But good movie for that one. I'm glad I watched it. That was the only new movie I watched for this draft, and it didn't quite make it into this kind of a list, but it was a good watch. So.
Okay, which brings me to, I get the number one pick of our favorite horror, religious horrors. And so this one is a little bit mainstream, but goddamn, I love this movie. I just rewatched it for the show probably a year ago or so. Prince of Darkness from 1987.
I was so worried it was going to miss out because I had it in my tied number two spot. I was like, shit, what if it doesn't make the list? Because it is the most, you know what's fun, crazy about it that I wasn't thinking about? In movies, right? In these kind of movies, say something happened to a scientist, they might call in the church. This is the only example I could ever think of where the church called in scientists.
Well, let me just point
so
out,
cool.
That was something, and what led me to think about this one, in both Immaculate and First Omen, the way, because we, of course, they're pregnant. Somebody's trying to bring about the Antichrist. The way that they get there is both very science-laden in both of those movies. And so it's the science trying to match the science to the religion and, you know, use science to really drive home the religion. And so it made me think about Prince of Darkness because Prince of Darkness is literally the theory is that Jesus is an alien and that he fought Satan and that Satan is now trapped in this liquid that they have in this church, and they've brought in a priest and all these scientists to study this liquid, and they think that the world's about to end because this liquid is like sentient and acting really crazy, and then they think that the liquid might actually be like not antimatter but anti-God, and that if it gets out, it's basically going to cause hell on earth, but it's starting to drive people around the church crazy. And so, it's this really heavy computer-laden nerd science version of God versus Satan. And
with Donald Pleasance as
Donald
a priest,
Pleasance
hilarious because he's a wuss.
Yeah.
And people having their face splooged on by green liquid goo where you're like, oh, God.
And then
God.
It melts them. Yeah, like, I honestly do not understand chunks of this movie, of how the science works and, you know, Jesus alien and Satan liquid, cool, but the big thing is that the green goo causes hell on earth, and then it gets absolutely crazy. And then it's trying to make an anti-god, and I don't even know how that's working, green goo, but it's really fascinating to watch. So go green Satan goo.
I can support any list that has that at number one. And also, I think it's one of the most rewatchable Carpenters that's not like the obvious choice. There's just something about it that's got more fun, practical things. Alice Cooper's in there. I mean, come on. That's one where the first time I saw it, I didn't fully get it. And then it became a favorite over the years.
Oh, yeah. Okay,
I would say an
discards.
objective. Well, I've just got an objective number one. The thing that I think deserves on a list like this that could be deserving that we haven't mentioned yet. And I really think when we talk about faith, this is the movie, the horror movie that really does it as Martyrs.
I wrote that down too. Yeah.
Yeah, it's just the movie that really, it's not a personal fave because it's a hard film to say it's a fave, but I think it's great. I just think it's one of the best looks at what faith is and what the church would go to if it thought it could really communicate to God. Yes, it would flay people. It would do all sorts of crazy stuff because if they thought, and I think this film does in a very dangerous way. Of course, I'm talking about the Blumhouse remake that no one knows exists. And I did watch and it shouldn't exist.
So on the factor of faith alone, of like the unbridled faith and how bad that can get, I also included Saint Maud, which I still question the degree to which it's a horror film because like nothing happens and then the world blows up in the last 5 minutes, but I'll fucking take that. And it is ultimately just about that unbridled faith and how chaotic it can be.
Yeah, no, I think that's one I've been meaning to rewatch because I love her new movie mm-hmm. so much. And I watched it on my laptop that time. So
same.
I really want to see it on a proper screen because I remember, you know, it had some moments and dread and tension.
Yeah. So, I also wrote down Blood on Satan's Claw, which isn't the greatest folk horror, but yeah. I love that one because it's like girl finds weird claw in town and city goes crazy. It's like the satanic panic in medieval times around a teen girl with crazy eyebrows finding this like claw in a field.
No, it certainly would fit. That's the kind of movie where I was purposely excluding because I'm thinking, well, that's more like The Wicker Man. Mm-hmm. Yes, they're religions, but they're more like folk religions and alternate sects and stuff like that. We could do a whole thing of worshiping Satan would be a whole different list. But that, I think this is a pretty good list. We'll post this on Letterboxd or something once we've got, you know, once the episode's out. So that those 10 films... Well, a nice mix between old and new.
I do have to say, I rewatched one movie for this that I was suddenly like, okay, you know what? I haven't seen it in a long time. I rewatched Demi Moore's The Seventh Sign.
Oh, I definitely haven't seen it in my adult years.
She's pregnant,
I remember the cover.
And like, basically the apocalypse comes and like the rivers turn to blood and like the locusts come and then the moon eats the earth. And she realizes that the world's about to end and that she's about to give birth to the God who's going to save the world if she dies. And it's like, it is 100% like straight up end of days done as a horror film. It was actually kind of enjoyable to rewatch. It wasn't as scary as I remembered it from when I was a kid. Like I remember it being terrifying when I was like 11 watching it, but it still worked.
I mean, there are so many, obviously, speaking of end of days, and there's just so many people in that subgenre. Let's do a quick countdown, just back and forth.
So at 10, I have the list.
You read it? Okay,
read it. I'll just read them off. At 10, we have The Unholy. At 9, we have The Sect, a.k.a. The Devil's Daughter. At 8, we have School of the Holy Beast. At 7, we have Hell Hole. At 6, we have The Sentinel. At 5, we have Satan's Slaves. At 4, we have Alice, Sweet Alice. At 3, we have The Last Exorcism. At 2, Don't Torture a Duckling. And at 1, Prince of Darkness.
Love it. And then special asterisks to our friend at Martyr, Pascal Leguiar of Martyrs. I have to look up what he's doing now. I would be curious to see if he made something a couple years ago that was okay.
Was that them?
No,
that was the Inside Guys.
Inside Guys, yeah. And after Deep House was that really cool French one. Because when you're talking about the French tenement buildings at the start of the show, they made that really cool one with the crazy big demon but that would be behind you, but the girls who were graffitiing walls and stuff.
Oh, that was so good. That movie ruled. Oh, gosh, I can't even remember the name of that.
I cannot remember, but that's what they made, and I love that.
Catalia or something like that. Yeah.
Deep House didn't work at all, really, unfortunately.
I really wanted Deep House to look. Yeah. But really quickly, I'm on Pascal Laguerre's. So he did Incident in a Ghostland a couple of years ago, and then he is currently doing a mini-series 2020, and that's been it.
He deserves to make another movie.
Like the last one big writing and directing has been Incident in a Ghostland.
It was okay. It was watchable. Yeah. It was trying to be French extreme vibes, but it wasn't, it didn't have the artistry of saying like Martyrs, you know.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, we need
religious horror.
Okay, yeah. Religious horror. Thank you all so much. I can tell you that next episode we are having on hold on, let me make sure that it is the next episode before I tease that it's the next episode.
We might have double booked people, then we'll have trouble.
No. Next episode is one of the biggest horror writers, contemporary horror writers. So, I'm excited to jump in and talk to him.
I can't wait to talk to Stephen King. Anyone else would be vastly disappointing. And then Clive Barker pops up. No, so I know exactly who you're talking about. And he's
the youngest.
We can call him the next version of it.
So he's coming.
I still want to read this book.
Brand new
I want
book. Do you not have it?
2 weeks. I don't have it. Give me a copy. I'll read it in 2 weeks. I can do it.
You got it.
I can do it. I can knock it out.
Okay. I think it's coming out end of the month as well. So yeah, you got to read it beforehand. It's short and it's a really fun read. Yeah, I have a copy.
Okay, bring it. Bring it tomorrow if you can.
I'm not done. I have like 4 chapters left. So
read tonight. You've got 4 chapters in you. I believe in you. I believe in you.
Okay, fine. Anyway. I'll see what I can do, but I'll get you a copy. Okay, y'all. Right. Thank you so much. If you're looking for some really weird shit, like some more School of the Holy Beast level shit, follow us over on Deep Cuts. We'll be there with another couple of titles during our down week, and we'll be back in 2 weeks. Thanks so much. The Colors of the Dark podcast is a Fangoria production. Producers and co-hosts are Rebecca McKendry and Elric Kane. Executive producers are Tara Ainsley and Abby Gould. Sonic branding by Michael Rodriguez. And, of course, our amazing sound engineer, Ernie Hurtado.